my daughter was young and she was learning to play the piano, her teacher would play classical pieces for her that eventually she would learn to play. And she'd play the whole thing for her and say, okay, now we're going to break it down and we're going to play those. And when my daughter told me that, I played her this song, Nut Rocker, from the Pictures in an Exhibition album by Emerson, Lake & Palmer. And I said, I'll be really impressed when you can play the keyboards like this. Of course, I was setting the bar a little bit high with my daughter, asking her to emulate Keith Emerson, one of the greatest keyboardists in rock history. And one of the people who became famous during what's known in rock and roll as the progressive rock era, that would essentially be from the late 60s until about the early 80s, mostly through the 1970s when bands like ELP and Yes and Pink Floyd and King Crimson and many others were creating a new rock and roll form. And it became known as prog rock or progressive rock. Well, now Dave Weigel has written a book about that era, and it's called The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Prog Rock, and he joins us now. Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Welcome to the show. Was Emerson, Lake & Palmer the first? Do they get the credit, or was it Yes, or which band would be the one that launched progressive rock?
There are quibbles about this. The book, I argue that the first progressive song, I think you credit to Procol Harum with A Whiter Shade of Pale. The first album, I would say, King Crimson and the Court of the Crimson King, really defined what the music would sound like.
Mm-hmm.
And Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Lake of Emerson, Lake & Palmer is the lead singer in King Crimson. So he takes a lot of what he learns from there. ELP become, I think, the preeminent progressive band, not just in terms of the giant fan base, giant concerts, but in what you were just playing. They are the most ready and giddy to incorporate classical music and rethink it through rock.
Was that a theme of progressive rock, the classical connection?
Oh, absolutely it was. So it was a largely English movement at first. It spread worldwide, especially progressive metal, which is kind of the last iteration of the music, is all over Europe, all over America. But a lot of the bands that formed this sound and kind of formed the ethos were from London and from kind of the English countryside and had similar training. Some of them were self-taught on rock instruments, but pretty similar set of influences, including English church music, Anglican church music, I should say, and classical composers. And it, kind of coming out of a media environment where it was easy to hear classical music, actually you had to go out and search for rock. So everyone had the same influences, and that's what I think made it interesting, that unlike punk explosion about 10 years later, where there's not a ton of diversity in between the sounds of various bands, there's a lot of diversity here. I think the commonality with most progressive groups is this organ anchoring everything, often with a lot of virtuoso talent.
Yeah, the organ and of course the Moog synthesizer.
Would
progressive rock exist if Robert Moog had not invented the synthesizer?
Mm-hmm. Not the way it became. So the Mellotron, actually, which is a much more simple electronic, actually kind of an analog instrument. If anyone's heard Strawberry Fields Forever, they've heard the Mellotron. That was what some of the first bands used. The Hammond organ, same deal, but they were more limited. The Moog synthesizer, as Emerson uses it, becomes this, not just a linchpin of the music, the ability to kind of blend these space-age sounds into what they're doing. But on You Were Playing Nut Rocker, I mean, he uses the Moog to play Aaron Copland, to play, this is actually more than one of Aaron Copland's songs, and sometimes gets feedback from the composers, if they're alive, what they think they're doing to the music. And it wouldn't have sounded like that. I mean, there is psychedelia birthed a lot of progressive rock, but the experimentation of this sort of music was a lot more electronic for a lot of bands. And the Moog was a huge part of that.
Who was a better progressive rock keyboard player, Keith Emerson or Rick Wakeman?
That's one of the great questions I hear people tussle over. I went to festivals, I went on a progressive rock cruise, I talked to a bunch of lots of fans, and that is a hard answer question. Emerson was more of an innovator. Wakeman, various stages, is probably more of a virtuoso in what he wants to do. And Emerson also was a little bit more ambitious in terms of trying to write real classical music. When the band made it, he was trying to write serious pieces to be played by orchestras.
Did you say
Wakeman? Yeah, Wakeman thought the what they were all part of was good, but worth occasionally in the British term taking the piss out of.
Did you say you went on a progressive rock cruise?
I did. I did drop that very briefly. Yeah, I went on what is the Cruise to the Edge, which is only one of at least two progressive rock cruises I'm aware of. And I didn't want a cliched cruise story. I was fascinated by the particular type of fan that would do such a thing. Close to 3,000 people on this boat in the Caribbean for 5 days, hobnobbing with fans. And they widened the definition of progressive rock in order to have this. But Yes and Marillion were the big features on the Cruise to the Edge. There were a couple metal bands that worked their way in, like Queensryche. And then there are these new young bands from Japan and Sweden that were, I think, revealed how much you could get away with under the label of progressive, how much you could play with the music, and how much you could surprise people without using typical rock chords and rock song structures, especially length. I mean, just long violin solos that were kind of ricocheting across this cruise ship.
Wow. I'm just trying to imagine what that is. Okay, everybody, we're going to have dinner, and then we're going to hear two songs by Yes. That'll be 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Yes. Yes and Marillion both had several nights to their own, and then a couple interviews in different parts of the boat. But most of them, I mean, John Wetton, who has unfortunately passed away, as Emerson, John Wetton, Tony Levin, some of the real icons of this music, just walking around the boat and hobnobbing with fans, and there was a relationship there that I didn't fully appreciate everyone thrown together on this boat.
Hey, was this before Chris Squire passed away?
It was before he did, yeah. He was, of the members of Yes, he and the new lead singer, still lead singer, John Davison, were probably the most game to go out and mingle with people. Before he passed away, so this is 2014, he passed away a year and change after that.
Yeah.
You know that Yes got finally inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame just a couple of months ago.
Yep.
What took so long?
There's a literal conspiracy, not in the wild-eyed sense. There is actually a resistance among members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame board to bring progressive rock in. So it took a very long time for Genesis. It took a long time for Rush. And then, Yes, there was actually a lobbying campaign by people with experience in political campaigns and pressure organizations just to break this logjam and get them in. It did take a long time. It's as I write in the book, and kind of a reason why I wrote the book. This has been so written out of rock history, and to the extent is part of hot rock history is as sort of an interregnum, a moment that was very regrettable that punk came along and saved us from.
Yeah.
And so that idea of what this music was pretty well ensconced in the sort of people who decide who's in that rock hall.
You know, this year the other inductees included Joan Baez and Tupac Shakur. It's funny to me that those can come in. Right, absolutely. Those fit the definition of rock. But Yes, nah.
Well, yeah, no, NWA got in before Yes. And I'm not sure how many more progressive bands will get in compared to a lot of big generic rock groups. It's a complicated relationship that critics have with this music now. They didn't always. And one thing I found in researching the book, and that this process involved reading thousands and thousands of magazines, fanzines, watching all the interviews from the time, it took a while for critics to turn on this. And in the early 1970s, there's a lot more critical respect for Emerson, Lake, and Palmer than there is for Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin's seen as a fun but derivative band ripping off blues tracks, whereas ELP, King Crimson, even the way they're covered by the press, it reminds me of the way that someone like Kanye West is covered now, as not just a cultural force, but we're trying to get every detail of this album because we know the band's going to do something new and exciting.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, Dave, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album, and of course the Beatles have re-released it for the 900th time. Every article talked about it being the first rock concept album, but as I pointed out on the air, it wasn't really a concept album through and through. It had the Sergeant Pepper thing at the beginning, and it had it towards the end before Day in the Life. But in between, there's no concept linking them together. I always thought of the first rock concept album as being the Moody Blues' Days of Future Past. Would you agree?
I'll agree, and we're talking about a space of months here, but I think the reason that sometimes denied credit is that the label suggested that the Moody Blues use this orchestration and build an album around that, whereas I guess people want to give the Beatles more credit for innovating what they did on Sgt. Pepper. But I'm happy to say that. I think that's the place it gets in the book. That's music that maybe the label did urge them to use the orchestration, but it wasn't necessarily predictable they would do such interesting things with it. There's a lot of kind of strings piled onto pop music. Yeah, but the Moody Blues write a series of songs around the passage of a day. There we go. They did invent something. They got a little bit of credit at a time, and credit I think that's been taken over the course of 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, it flows through the day, and you have great songs like Tuesday Afternoon and, of course, Nights in White Satin, which I did not realize until I read your book, was literally about satin sheets.
Yeah. No, that was something. Talking to these musicians, I was pleased with how not pompous they were. Now, if they were pompous, they're usually in on the pomposity. They're kind of being big about the music for a point. Just as often, or sometimes more often, they were just having fun with it. They'd ask for the interpretation of a lyric, and it was just, it not together the way any kind of pop lyric wants together. The idea that these bands were obsessed with sci-fi and fairies and stuff was just kind of belied by how much fun they were having.
Yeah.
And, with the occasional exception, like John Anderson and Yes are pretty, John Anderson himself is pretty into writing big mystical Eastern religious lyrics.
Yeah.
But the rest of the band just kind of nods their heads and plays.
Is it true that Procol Harum's Whiter Shade of Pale was inspired by a cigar commercial?
It was. Well, there is a Air on the G-String was sampled. The Bach composition was used in the cigar commercial, and it was what the band used for inspiration to write the song. And there was a fight, by the way, a long legal fight over who deserved credit. And Michael Brooker kind of won this for writing this, or pointing out in court that the song was really not that interesting without this organ part that he very proudly cribbed from Bach, but he cribbed it from the commercial. And that's one thing I've seen through a lot of music I've written about, is that you don't need to necessarily get it from the wellspring. You get inspiration trickled down from all kinds of sources. And that was, the progressive musicians were just so open-minded about what you could get the inspiration from.
I was a big fan of a band called Renaissance, which combined classical and choral music with rock and roll. And the reason I loved it so much was the voice of their lead singer, a woman by the name of Annie Haslam, whose mm-hmm. voice on Prologue and Ocean Gypsy and Carpet of the Sun. She's just amazing. I never heard her do anything after that. And it also makes me think, where are the other women of the progressive rock era? Were there any?
Not a ton. There's Sonia Christina from Courage Air. There are female vocals that sometimes get brought in on albums. Not a lot of progressive female musicians in the band, and that's not atypical. It's ironic because the Nice, Keith Emerson's band before Emerson Lake and Palmer, begins as a backup for a soul singer, a female soul singer. So they kind of took from that and made their own movement, but. No, that is a bit of a blind spot in this sort of rock history. I think it's also a reason why it's gotten a little bit less attention. Punk has at least enough female icons, but I think people can tell that story and they feel like they're being more even-handed. I have seen more female musicians in modern progressive music, not metal, but the ones I was talking about. I've seen progressive female artists who grew up on some of this stuff. On Marillion, and for whatever reason, I see at Marillion shows, there's more gender balance than I'm used to from a lot of other bands. But you're right, the classic 70s stuff was very male, just like heavy metal, just like a lot of punk.
Here in St. Louis, Dave, we have a Pink Floyd cover band called El Monstero. As far as I know, they are the most popular cover band of any band anywhere. I mean, they play at an outdoor amphitheater here, and they get 10,000 people coming and playing. They'll do a week of shows during Thanksgiving, and they'll sell out every one. It's a huge deal when El Monstero is in concert, and their concerts are a very faithful recreation of what a Pink Floyd concert would be, running through pretty much all of their albums. Does that exist for other progressive rock bands that you know of?
Yeah, there's the Musical Box, which is a very good Quebec-based Genesis cover band. And Genesis have actually cited them as a reason why it doesn't make sense for them to do a real reunion tour, because this band has learned every single move down to Peter Gabriel's makeup of the really progressive 1970 to 1974 iteration of Genesis, before Steve Hackett leaves the band, before Peter Gabriel leaves the band.
You mean when they stopped being a progressive rock band and became a pop band under Phil Collins?
Yeah, which took a while, but this is the Supper's Ready, I Know What I Like in Your Wardrobe, that era of the group, this incredibly faithful act. And there's actually, they're a hybrid. There's a band called Three Friends that's members of Gentle Giant, playing on, sort of paying tribute to their music and continuing this pretty unique sound, this Renaissance influence rock sound, but occasionally with different members. Same thing with Soft Machine. There is a Soft Machine legacy that maybe has one member of what the band originally was and keeps going. But there was a 21st Schizoid band, was a tribute to King Crimson, whose singer was so well-liked, well-respected by Robert Fripp, that when he reunited King Crimson 3 years ago, he hired him on. He'd already started collaborating with him on some solo projects and then hired him on to be a new singer of the band.
I was just wondering, we were talking about how a lot of the folks are following the bands that are older now and stuff like that. Are you into any of the new jam bands like String Cheese Incident or Fish or
Dave
Widespread?
Matthews.
Dave Matthews. Do you hear influences? I mean, I go to String Cheese Incident and I hear influences from so many of the earlier bands in that. Do you notice that, or do you go check them out at all?
Yeah, I got more interested in some of those bands and researching this book, but they've never quite sung out as much to me. I just think there's a lot of interesting technique being displayed, but not as much innovation in the music. I mean, when I listen to Fish, I kind of know. I can't predict exactly where the song's going to go melodically, but the track they're running around is pretty small. Or the track Yes is running around is 100 miles long and floating in space somewhere.
The other thing that was key to that era of progressive rock was the album art. I mean, back in the days of vinyl, you would buy the album, you would fold it out, you would use it to separate the twigs and stems from your weed, and then you would smoke that while you listened to this and stared at these Roger Dean pictures, right?
Completely, and that's something that has come up in other conversations I had about the book. When people ask, why did this fade, I think how long should any genre last? It did last about its natural existence. But in the early 1970s, there is a bit less competition for your entertainment time and dollar. And progressive music was just so encompassing. It was a combination of art that you could sit back and really luxuriate in and look over.
Yep.
And it was the concert that's giant happening, often with a tailgate, usually with, like, joints getting lit up, with sound concussing all around you, a stage show with a lot of effort put into it, as opposed to, I go to lots of concerts now, but a lot of them have people in T-shirts kind of standing on stage, thrown together without a lot of thought.
Yeah.
You would hear with the video components and dancers and light shows, et cetera. So they always put on more of a show than a lot of comparable rock, and the album art was a big part of it.
Yeah. That album art doesn't matter that much in the era of the digital download.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
There's no art to look at all. Dave Weigel's book is called The Show That Never Ends, The Rise and Fall of Prog Rock. If you lived through that era and you liked this music, this is a great read for you. You can pick it up now. I appreciate your time today, Dave. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.